We are actually in the midst of a technological sea change.
The amount of change we're going to see over the next 5 years, 10 years, will dwarf everything that's happened over the last 30. So now you have to know how to use that stuff. So either software works for you, or you work for software, and once the software takes over, you're gone, you're gone, you're gone, you're gone. You're gone. You're gone.
There are some tasks that can be done better or cheaper by the machines, but even if for the material that are translated by machine translation system, post-editing, you still need a human being to make sure that the content is correct.
Jobs will change. Some jobs will be created, some jobs may go away, but the future is one where AI and digital labor is here, and so it's important that everybody learn this technology.
AI. It's here, it's now, but did anyone actually ask for it? And how will it affect how we teach and how we learn? Hello, and welcome back to The Secret Life of Language, a podcast from the School of Languages and Linguistics at the University of Melbourne. I'm Professor John Hadjeck.
And I'm Dr. Yu Hao. Thanks for joining us for this fourth in a series of episodes in which we look at how generative AI is impacting teaching and research activities in university settings.
In this episode, we're moving the focus to Gen AI and its impact on languages and linguistics, which happens to be more our line of work, and specifically on the areas of translation and translation studies.
Machine learning and increasingly generative AI technologies have come to dominate the translation industry. So what does that mean for the career prospects of professional translators? How does generative AI fit into today's translation workflows? And is there still a case for fully human translation?
Plus, later in the episode, we'll be exploring what role, if any, Gen AI could offer in efforts to bolster or revitalize minority languages. Can we look to AI technologies to teach, translate, or generate useful new content in the world's indigenous languages? Or will the overwhelming amount of training data from the major languages mean low-resource languages will be left out in the cold?
But first, to the profession of translation, which has already been revolutionized by machine learning over the past decade, and is only set to change further as large language model-based tools take hold.
Although Yu Hao and I both come from professional translation backgrounds, we've brought a couple of translation-focused researchers into the studio to help give us a picture of a field in transition.
In this episode, we try to get some answers to our questions from our two guests. Professor Anthony Pym is part of our very own School of Languages and Linguistics. Anthony, tell us about yourself.
My name's Anthony Pym. I'm Professor of Translation Studies at the University of Melbourne. Among other things, I teach AI when we train translators here in master's programs and undergrad programs. And with Yu Hao, right here today, I'm the co-author of How to Augment Language Skills. And this is about the use of AI and machine translation in both language learning and the training of translators, coming out very soon at Routledge, but we're not here to sell books today.
And can I ask what language pairs you work with in your profession as a translator?
Spanish, Catalan, French, basically some German into English.
And also joining us is PhD candidate Elise Ting.
My name is Elise. I'm currently a second-year doctoral student in Asia Institute at University of Melbourne. My research interests include machine translation, post-editing, and ethnographic research in translation studies. My doctoral project explores the translation workflow that integrates machine translation in the translation industry.
Welcome both of you to The Secret Life of Language. So, Anthony, not everyone is on the bandwagon for using these technologies for translation, are they?
First, there's a lot of prejudice out there. against first machine translation and secondly generative AI that comes from journalists and philosophers who've never actually worked with these technologies. Another doctoral student, Kerr, whose thesis was precisely on this, he got people to read literary text that were done raw machine translation, post-edited machine translation, and a professionally published translation, sentence by sentence, getting their reactions and their pleasure. And the one that came out on top was the post-edited machine translation. He happened to pick a few texts that were not very well translated professionally. Okay, humans are not perfect. Humans also do subpar translations. So we can show statistically that there's no reason for prejudice. Machine translation will make mistakes and not be pretty. But you fix it up. You post-edit it. And a good post-edit can make that a very good literary text. Now, with generative AI, a really cool thing to do is to go to Gemini. That's the Google Gemini AI. And you get one translation. And then you say, regenerate. I don't like your translation. Give me another one. And I do this for my village in Spain where I live, the tourist discourse. So regenerate for tourists. And it gives you another version, which is so good, so beautiful, so exactly the right words in for that discourse. And if I don't like that, do it again. And it's becoming more and more adaptive, going towards what the text should be and away from what the source text is. There's tremendous creativity in the technology. So when, you know, philosophers are telling me, oh, it's not creative, it's the end of human creativity. What a lot of rubbish.
But, Anthony, are we not reaching the point of singularity? I mean, does generative AI spell the end of the line for translators and interpreters?
So the question is, what is translating and what parts have been surpassed by the computer? One that's obvious with generative AI is documentation, the location of information. You know, it can search the internet or anything huge far faster than any one individual can. And so we're obviously surpassed there. However, translating has two things. It's finding out what's there in the text and finding out what it means or could mean. But then you have to select one of the many interpretations that are available and present that to somebody to have an effect. And on this second part, human intervention can improve on AI results. And increasingly, we can use generative AI to check and revise and offer alternatives to what the human translation is. So on the degenerative part of translation, AI can do it much better than a human. On the selective part and communicating with somebody downstream towards the actual effect of the translation, human intervention improves the text enormously. You will still need humans there for that part of the process. End of the profession? End of parts of the profession? Absolutely. Absolutely. Translators will still be needed for any high-risk, high-stakes communication act where a mistake could have serious consequences. You need a human in the loop.
But why does it just have to be high stakes? Surely any stakes...
Because we like to be paid, John.
No.
We've got to be paid lots of money as well.
No. But, I mean, human translators working with machine translation, surely. You know, that's the way of the future, isn't it?
Look, of all the words that are translated in the world, we did the calculation, you know, 0.64% are done by professional humans. The rest is done by machines, by automation. But this has not taken work away from the translators. That's my point. These are tasks like you with a taxi driver or, you know, reading and scanning a menu and getting it. You would never have got a professional translator to do that anyway. So what's happening is with automation, translation's just become a general social activity. It's been democratized. Everybody can do it.
Anthony, so what kind of skills can be technology, can be automation resistant?
That's the hard thing. I'm really looking at stuff the automation can help us do better. One is getting trust. One of the things we find out about communication situations that are high stakes is that people have to trust the communicator. And they're not going to trust a machine, an anonymous machine. They're going to trust a person. In COVID, we discovered this when we tried to get information to all the multilingual communities around Melbourne. they would go to a trusted person and get information, typically from a doctor. Okay, or you get your religious leader to send the message, and you need a person for that. Now, without trust, translation can't really work as a full communication act because the receiver doesn't know what's on the other side.
But people use Google Translate regularly and they kind of trust it, don't they?
No, they have low trust. This is what we're finding out with research on the actual usage of machine translation. How do people use it? Jurong Chu has done research on subtitles, machine generated. And how do people process it and understand it? They figure out it's machine translation. They switch to low trust reception. Like if there's a mistake there, I'll screen it out. We're finding new modes of reception that are specifically low trust when you don't trust the surface level of the text.
But you use it nonetheless.
Yeah. We did some interviews there. In Spain, I was doing some interviews with a translator. She said, yeah, we get machine translation all the time, like instruction manuals, you know. And we learn to understand not what the text says, but what it should say. You know, you've got this double reception. People are getting used to working with that low-level trust relationship.
So the scenarios you're talking about are rather low stakes, like subtitles for movies or videos, entertainment, or instruction manuals for toasters and the like. But what about emergency communication, when you want to get across messages that really matter? Say, life or death situations. Do people still have the same kind of reaction when they suspect machine translation?
We've done research led by Professor John Hadjick here on the use of machine translation for emergency communication. And yes, it makes mistakes. And yes, it makes mistakes in high stakes passages, you know, like telling you to park your car towards an approaching fire in the Chinese translation and things. And we did test with questionnaires and people get the questionnaire wrong. So yes, there are real problems there. You can overcome those problems. But we didn't put people in an actual bushfire to see what they did. You know, we would hope that common sense can kick in and people will not follow the text in that situation. Before people say you never use machine translation or AI for emergency communication, hey, the bushfire is approaching. The one value you have is speed. And if you need speed, then you've got to use the technology. And the way to work with it is to write your texts in such a way as to solve the machine translation problems before they happen, to make that text super clear, very short sentences, no pronouns, and then it'll go through, then it could work.
We talked about wider social impacts, right? How machine translation or Gen AI is used in everyday communication. So now I have a question for Elise, who is just back from her fieldwork. So Elise did some participatory observation at a few Melbourne-based translation companies. So tell us about that, Elise.
Regarding the use of translation technology, so for translation memory software, it has been widely used. I barely see a translation company that don't use translation memories these days.
I think we need some context here. What do you mean by translation memory software?
Translation memory software is a database that can store the previous translations. And then when you come across new translation, you can reuse the previous translation. It will show you the matches between the new translation and the previous ones.
And does the translator then have their own sort of database that they work on, or is it something that's shared communally?
It's not shared to the public. The translation memory is usually built by the translation company. The translator can personalize their own translation memory based on the jobs that they did. But in the context of translation industry, when we talk about language service providers or translation companies, they usually build up the translation memory for their clients, especially the regular client. So whenever they assign the jobs to the translator, they can send through the translation memory together to the translator.
So you were observing how these companies employ this technology, yes?
Yeah, as I mentioned, translation memory software is widely used. And for the machine translation, it's quite interesting. There are two main ways of applying it. The first way is the translation company, they use machine translation to translate the source text as an initial process before they send it to the translator. And then they ask the translator to correct the machine translation output. That's the first way of integrating machine translation. Another way is the translation company do not have specific requirements on whether or not you use machine translation or not, but it's off translator's decision to decide what kind of approach they want to use, if they want to adopt machine translation or not.
So, just to provide some deeper context here about machine learning and how it contrasts with the large language model-based generative AI that's come online more recently, I put the question of how the two technologies differ to Dr. Laia Freiermann, a natural language processing specialist from the School of Computing and Information Systems at the University of Melbourne. We spoke at length with Laia in the second episode of this series.
One more property of these generative AI models, the ChatGPTs and so forth, is that they are not trained to solve any specific task, right? They're just a language model which can generate language, but you can use them to do question answering, to do translation, to do all sorts of things you want them to do, dialogue modeling. And that's very different to pretty much all NLP models which came out up to 4 or 5 years ago, where you might have had this general model, but you needed to fine-tune it to do a specific task, or you developed it from scratch to do a specific task. And the traditional machine translation models, they were developed from scratch specifically to do machine translation, and they cannot do anything else. So this is, just in terms of the architecture, something completely different. The whole architecture of the traditional machine translation models is fine-tuned to just this task.
So, but then, with respect to the translation bit, is neural machine translation the basis for Gen AI's translation capacity, or?
Again, the underlying technology is similar in the sense that it is neural networks. The exact architecture is a little bit different, I assume, but this transformer architecture with the attention, this has just been incorporated into all sorts of models, and I'm sure the best neural machine translation models are building on this transformer architecture as well, but they are specifically trained on parallel training data to do the translation. Whereas ChatGPT and these models, they pick these translation capability up as a sort of emergent capability, which comes out because they are so incredibly large that based on the very intricate representations that they can capture in all the parameters that they have, that allows them to do translation as part of their general capabilities.
So it's a separate system. It's not like translation, it's an add-on to Gen AI.
No, it's an, you could call it an emergent ability.
So before the current wave of large language models and generative AI, there was, about 8 or 9 years ago, an adoption of neural models in things like Google Translate and similar products. Listeners may recall there was a big jump in the quality of Google Translate around that time. Before that, it could be laughably bad. Things suddenly got a lot better.
And the translation industry was affected for about 18 months afterwards.
In what way?
Less jobs. People would say, oh, we'll put it through Google. After 18 months, they realized there's still a lot of mistakes there, still a lot of errors, and the industry recuperated quite quickly, which is important for AI because I think we're going through the same thing right now.
So just to go back to the translator's toolkit, you've got machine translation and you've got translation memory software. Is that right?
The translation memory software, it's not separated from machine translation because translation memory software these days integrate many other translation technology as well. So they have machine translation, they have terminology management tool and project management tool as well.
Can you give us the names of a couple of these products?
Trados.
T-R-A-D-O-S.
Yes, now owned by the biggest language company in the world.
RWS.
RWS, okay. What does that mean, the biggest language company in the world?
They bought out SDL, which was previously the second biggest. They bought the translation software, they provide translation services, they also provide marketing and advertising.
So RWS offers the product Trados, correct?
Yes, they bought it from another company which had bought it from a previous or a smaller company.
What's so good about it? Because it puts everything together.
It has machine translation integrated into the system. So the system is like a toolkit. So it's a software suite, right? You have everything a professional translator would need in it. So once they work on a specific translation task, they can look some words up in the dictionaries and then make reference to previous translations. Either it's in the public database or their own translation memories. And then at the same time, they can have multiple machine translations to turn to. They don't have to generate a lot of different versions of translations themselves. All they need to do is to select the final one, if that makes sense.
Okay, my source text over here divided up. Click on the sentence I want to translate. Over here, I get a translation memory suggestion, because I've worked for the same client before. And I get something from the glossary that I've put in, because I'm working in this technical field. And I can get one, two, or three machine translation versions. Now, I select the one that I like most over here. It comes in the middle, and I correct it. Nice. I'm still translating. The work of the translator is called post-editing. We are editing after the fact, and that's what we get paid for these days. Mind you, there are whole segments there where you get absolute rubbish, and you say, wipe that away, and I'm going to translate from scratch.
What about confidentiality when you're working with these sorts of automated tools?
It depends on the license. Because anything you do in Google is swept up and kept by Google. You know, a good translation pair is gold for the industry. So they're interested in picking up all our work and using it. And that's why there's a problem of confidentiality. If these systems are online, the companies we work with are taking our data. And so you have to pay more money to get confidentiality.
So who owns a translation pair, or is it owned by no one?
We're generating translations and we're generating memories. And at the beginning in the 90s, when we had translation memories, translators kept the memories because this is our stock in trade. Then the systems went online. The first one was Lionbridge, which is the second biggest language company. And you had to translate online. As soon as you put your translation in, it's gone. It's in the company database. They own it. And that was the end of the legal debate, the technology. And it's what's happening these days as well.
So, Elias, you were talking earlier about workflows, how machine translation or AI are integrated into workflows, right? So I'm wondering who in the industrial setting has the final say on whether to use those technologies or not.
So one case is that when the project manager is a professional translator himself or herself or themselves, they can decide on whether or not to use machine translation or not. They will consider whether the context or the purpose or considering the time frame, like to make that decision of whether or not to use machine translation or not. But project managers are not necessarily professional translators. So in this case, translators have the freedom to decide on the use of machine translation.
I'm surprised that they would not opt for machine translation in any case. And I imagine it depends on factors such as length of the text, etc. But it's so labor intensive. Why wouldn't you, in any case, just start with machine translation?
For example, for the literature work, they will not use machine translation. And they will the case that they will use machine translation, legal documents, even though, like, they, of course, there's confidentiality concern. So the way of their approach is they remove all the identifiable information and then process the source text into the machine translation. And they say the machine translation output is usually very good when it comes to legal documents and contracts. The language is quite structural in this case. So for legal documents, they will use machine translation. And also for business text and marketing.
Medical text probably as well?
Medical, yes. Medical text has a lot of terminologies. Based on the interview that I did with the translators, they say that for the medical terminology, they have issue with that, but machine translation get it right.
So say you're using a product like Trados, which is commercial translation software you're paying for. If you're translating a legal document, I assume you may need to anonymize or mask some of the identities in the text. Are you, the translator, removing it before you use Trados, or is Trados doing it?
Oh, you have to, the human has to do it.
Okay, but since you're paying for the software, why can't they magically do the masking for you? Or is it that they can't be trusted?
Sometimes they say they won't release the data to the third party, but do they take the data and then use the data to train the system, or we don't know, right?
Yeah,
but even though we're paying for that.
We will never release it to a third party implies, hey, we're going to use it ourselves.
So, Ellis, can you tell us about how translators themselves are feeling about Gen AI at the moment? And also, what impact is the technology having on pay rates for professional translators?
Surprisingly, the people that I interview, the industry stakeholders that I interview, they are not worried about machine translation or generative AI taking away their jobs. So one reason could be, as the workflow that I just mentioned, they may use machine translation to improve the speed or the productivity, but like they're still getting the same pay. So actually, like they can earn more, in if that makes sense, like when you think about the hourly rate or something. So they don't complain about machine translation. And on the company side, I interviewed some of the senior management members of the translation company because they believe that the translation jobs will be linked to the liability in the future when the use of machine translation and generative AI become more popular. So the client will never trust machine translation or generative AI because on the terms and conditions of these tools, it has already specified that they were not responsible for the legal consequences. So in this case, the clients do need someone, which is human translator, or the translation company that do their translation jobs to be liable to the translation.
It's good to know they have the translators have the same pay.
Yes.
It tells a different story. My personal experience, last year when I worked as a freelance translator for one of the companies here, I was paid 40% less because I was required to use a machine translation memory software. And then the database was empty. So I created translation memory for the company in the meantime and paid 40% less. So I said, oh, okay, it's not a very happy story.
Did you complain?
I wouldn't be able to. I'm a freelancer. And it's just a one-time job. But I'm happy to know that actually some of the translators' pay wouldn't get affected because of the use of machine translation. But are they happy?
They are. And surprisingly, all the experienced translators I interviewed, they are very open to machine translation and generative AI.
Okay. But for all that, we're still talking about the separate jobs of full translation versus supposed editing of translations done by AI, right? So if we take this as separate skills, are we seeing a difference in pay rates?
It's approximately 30% to 50% difference.
It's obviously cheaper to hire a post-editor than a translator in that sense, correct?
Yes, and it also depends on the language pairs and also the translators, the rates themselves. Like, they do not apply the same rates to all the translators. Translators do have the freedom to negotiate their pay rates with the companies.
The industry is sick, and there are several reasons. Firstly, the problem of rates, you get paid by the hour. Doesn't matter what you do, just get paid by the hour, like lawyers, billable hours, and you solve that problem, but the industry doesn't want to go there. Do you know why? Because the big companies are getting richer and the freelancers are getting less work. Not poorer, but less work. Okay. Now, we have surveys, reliable surveys of the North American and European language industries. These are the companies you haven't heard about in Australia. And over 10 years, we've got enormously increasing profits for companies with over 50 employees, so fairly big companies, and declining profits for small companies with fewer than 10 employees, and often they're freelancers with one or two employees, many of whom have disappeared from the market. So the effect of technology over 10 years, well, we don't know if technology is a cause, this is my reading, the profits from the increased productivity have gone to the big companies who often own the technology as well. So they've got every interest on both sides of the equation. They sell the technology and they reap the benefits of the technology. In Australia, there is information that says that established translators, the people that Elise has been interviewing, are quite happy because they've got their clients, they've established, they've negotiated rates of pay. If you have lots of experience, you can ask for a higher rate, because you presumably provide a superior service. And young people entering who are enthusiastic idiots, who will work for nothing just to get into the industry, and in between, we have serious signs of people leaving the industry. Why? Because they can't get enough to live on, or because they can use their skills teaching a language rather than translating. So translation has become very much a gig economy, because for many with the smaller social demands, it's not regular work. And the number of jobs has been declining because people can turn to machine translation and AI.
So Anthony, you and I just put out a book. Again, for the listener, the name is How to Augment Language Skills, Generative AI and Machine Translation in Language Learning and Translator Training. So there's a chapter in the book on how to use translation technologies in language teaching classes. We'll list a total of 57 different activities there. Can you just share with us some of the general principles?
Oh, okay. General principles. Number one, your students are using it anyway, before you do anything. You know, they know how to use Google, they know how to use generative AI, and they think they're doing it to cheat. You've got to bring it in, show people how to do it well, how to use it productively, and how to learn from it. Because it's a great, great language learning tool that really threatens not translators, but language teachers, because it's so damn good. All right? So the activities that people can do for the translation part, number one, do not let them start from the technology. You do your translation and get the technology to revise it, or ask it what can be improved. There's a whole lot of things. You've got to break that initial illusion that if it's a printed translation, it's perfect. And that's easy to do. You just compare what the different technologies do. Okay, so comparing outputs is one thing, or regenerating in Gemini, as I said. There's things like speaking to it. The orality is really coming back in a big way. We think translation's just writing. A lot of the technologies, you can speak to it and get a version, and it can speak back to you. You can have a spoken conversation. But also, when you speak your translations or speak the text you want translated, it comes out far more naturally than when writing. So there's a lot of orality to be introduced there. We have lots of activities with, for example, subtitling. Students love subtitling. They get their favorite video clip and put it into a different language, or they can really subvert the, you know, put crazy subtitles on there to subvert the intention of the original clip. All that can be done with machine translation and AI and post-editing.
I look around and I see some teachers, language teachers or translation teachers, are quite skeptical about machines.
On X, I put publicity for the book that we've just done, right? And so some smart-ass translator came and said, and when do they learn to translate without technology, right? And I said there, after 2016. Because after 2016 with neural machine translation, it makes no sense to train people to translate manually without the technology. I think we published a text, an article on this, on students resisting
literary. So we did experiment with students for 3 years in a row. So that was Anthony's class. So we put students into two groups. So one translate Agatha Christie from scratch, which means fully human, and another group with the assistance of DeepL. And then the results is quite intriguing. So, of course, the post-editor worked significantly faster than from-scratch translators. But then in terms of the quality, they actually made different kinds of mistakes. So for post-editors, because they have kind of a draft generated by machine translation, there are less errors related to understanding. So then the other group, that's human translators, they sometimes took a wild departure from the original meaning. But at the same time, the human translators, what they produced is more idiomatic. The post-editors sometimes stick to what machine generates. Therefore, it's quite literal and sometimes doesn't make sense that much. So it's not always better, but it does increase the productivity, that speed. In terms of the quality, it's it depends.
If you then ask those same students who've done the experiment in class, did you go faster with one? Yes, with post-editing. Is the quality significantly different? No, not really, because we get numbers in class.
Yeah.
And then will you use post-editing for literary texts? No. We've shown them the benefits, and they don't want to see the benefits. They don't want to use it.
So for those post-editors who were originally working as fully human translators, is there no benefit for them to have had that background? Maybe they'll never go back to that, but because they've had that experience, doesn't that lead them to be better at post-editing?
Absolutely.
The students who did the post-editing were actually more open-minded towards the idea of using machine translation in their future literary translation tasks.
The people who did it fully human didn't want to use machine translation in future because it's bad, you know, it makes stupid literal mistakes.
Popular beliefs.
Popular beliefs, yes. Whereas the people who had the actual experience of post-editing...
Well, it's actually not that bad, right?
...were more open-minded.
You earlier gave us a fairly grim assessment of the industry. I assume that means fairly grim prospects for professional translators too. So as someone who teaches translation in a university setting, I mean, what message are you giving your students about this possible career choice?
So rather than asking the opinions of translation employers or teachers, we actually ask what do recent graduates say. They have insider's views, right, in two worlds, professional translator training and the industry. And it's quite interesting because we would assume technology is around us and everybody would say, oh, technology is the skill sets we want to have. But that's not true. So first, not everybody became professional translators and interpreters. We had only 30% of the graduates entered the translation industry. And then the other one-third became language teachers, with the rest of the one-third working in the areas other than language or translation or did further study.
The important thing is that only ever in master's level training of translators, only one third have ever gone into the narrow industry. And the skills we teach are highly transversal. They're communication skills, multilingual communication, used not just in language teaching, but a whole range of industries, especially journalism, marketing, air traffic control. We had one student become an air traffic controller. And she translated the manual into Chinese. Okay, right, yeah. Anywhere they can go. Mm-hmm. So highly transversal skills. And when I speak with, this was a conference in Europe of industry players, and they're talking about the talent crunch, you know, the talent crunch, we can't get enough employees with good talent. And I said, well, of course, you're not paying them enough. And they said, no, we're paying big money. I said, well, what kind of talent do you want? They want people who can communicate with clients, who can sell their very expensive products but can communicate with the clients, make people feel good about the technology, client welfare. And those are skills that we should be able to foster in our teaching.
So I guess what they want is customer relations people who have excellent language skills.
Absolutely. And if you know how to translate, it's even better. And if you know about the technologies, even better.
So can we move the topic to interpreting? Interpreting is, of course, spoken translation. What's the impact of AI and machine learning on interpreting? Elise?
Regarding the use of generative AI in the field of interpreting, my observation in the translation company, because they also handle some interpreting jobs, the interpreter will use generative AI to prepare their glossary for an interpreting job. In the interpreting class, we also encourage students to interact with generative AI to prepare for their interpreting task.
So you say preparation. What kind of preparations do they do?
Okay, so before the job happens, you will have a brief about what is this job about and the parties involved. You have background information. So the interpreter will, based on the background information, and search the domain-specific terminology or context-specific terminology in generative AI, just using the prompt that provide me with the words or terminology in this field.
Right. So if I'm understanding correctly, it's about knowing the contextual info. So you're being given a lot of things to read.
Yes.
And that's where generative AI can help, like generating the summaries. So you don't have to go from cover to cover, some summaries of contextual info. And then you will use generative AI and throw in materials in both languages you're working on. So it generates the bilingual paired terminologies.
So it's all preparatory work. There's not yet the AI technology to use during the interpretation itself, is there?
Okay, traditionally, in court interpreting and depositions in the United States especially, what counts is a written record? So an interpreter will be there listening to what's coming in, but also reading a transcript that's automatically generated. And since the transcript is what counts, that's what they pay more attention to. You can correct it on the fly because you've got the audio coming in. Now, in conference interpreting these days, you'll have exactly what Elise described. You'll have your glossary. I used to do that manually. I would get a job and I asked 3 days beforehand for articles, recent articles. I used to do medical conferences. And I would go elaborately by hand, develop a glossary, have the glossary there so I could bring it up on the computer if I needed it. The terms, but it was really laborious. Now it's much, much easier. And now in the booth, you can have, obviously, speech-to-text generation of the source text coming in, of what's coming in, and a machine translation as well, which is usually pretty crummy, but when you're stuck for a word, hey, you look down there, you've got a suggestion. Or you can't remember what a number was, which is one of the classic problems in conference interpreting, simultaneous. Usually you have two people there, one writes down the numbers for you. You can see it these days. You can go back and see it. So it's improving the work in the booth, which is still very intensive and exhausting, exhilarating. It's like adrenaline stuff going, yeah? Simply by having speech-to-text transcript and speech-to-text translation as fallbacks. Like, it's the same technology you use for live subtitles on sports events. You know, it's got mistakes in it, but hey, it's live and it's useful. Absolutely useful. I don't know about Gen AI as being a big advance on neural in that particular situation, except for the preparation phase, obviously.
It seems to be that these technologies bring about a kind of democratization to translation. I don't mean that professionals aren't still needed for quality control, quality assurance, but now it can be used by anyone. It creates a level playing field on some level. Is that a good thing?
Very good thing for my son's generation because they have access to knowledge and creative products produced in across language barriers. And we can see that happening on the internet. A very bad thing, though, if that means people don't want to learn languages, if they think this can replace language learning. So the big trick we have to get across is that this is part of language learning. It's a language learning tool, and that's why the technology should be taught in all foreign language learning. That's the main thing.
I mean, learning a language is more than just learning a language. It's the whole social experience. It's a social human endeavor.
Translating is a social endeavor too.
So we're now joined by one of our producers, Eric, to lend us a hand here in the studio. Eric, I should say, is a real person, and his words and intonation are his own. But we've been, well, disguising his voice with AI cloning over these recent episodes. So, Eric, what do you sound like this time around?
Hi, John. Well, this is what I sound like. I hope it's natural enough, or at least tolerably so. So, in that last segment, you spoke with our guests about translation in this evolving world of generative AI. I just briefly want to demonstrate something along those lines in the AI voice cloning space. Using the GenAI prowess of a company called 11 Labs, we'll take some audio of a speaker, someone I think you'll know, and then hear the very same voice speaking in translation in other languages, using AI-generated dubbing of one language to another that's super fast and hopefully accurate and convincing. So have a listen to the original audio first and the translations that follow, and then I'd like to get your thoughts.
What challenges has generative AI brought to the university setting, in your honest opinion?
Apa tantangan yang dibawa oleh AI generatif ke dalam lingkungan universitas menurut Anda yang jujur? ما هي التحديات اللي جلبها الذكاء الاصطناعي التوليدي إلى البيئة الجامعية برأيك الصادق؟ Aké výzvy podľa vášho názoru priniesla generatívna umelá inteligencia do univerzitného prostredia? 당신의 솔직한 의견으로 생성형 인공지능이 대학교 환경에 가져온 도전 과제는 무엇인가요? 아프기 이만달 라임의 generative 크리트림 부디맛타네 위시비디알레이크 세팅메 콘시 주노티안 라이헤. Quali sfide ha portato l'intelligenza artificiale generativa nell'ambiente universitario, secondo la tua onesta opinione? 在您看来，生成式人工智能给大学环境带来了哪些挑战
？Wow, that's pretty amazing. I didn't know that I could speak fluent Arabic and Hindi, and quite a few other languages. I mean, that's extraordinary. That would have taken just a few seconds to generate. Would have taken me thousands of learning hours to get to that same level, and I probably wouldn't have.
The Chinese one, it's really, really good. So it's a little bit idiomatic in terms of a specific wording, but then it's not bad. It sounds like my colleague who is not native speaker of Chinese, but then they speak quite fluently in that specific language. Wow. Yeah, so that was a wow.
So it sounds non-native?
Definitely non-native. So it's coming from a English-speaking background, but then that specific person studied Mandarin in Taiwan, so it's just a little bit accent over there. So,
and how is it grammatically?
Almost perfect. It's an idiomatic use of specific word. So saying, so university context, so we rarely say that in Chinese. So that was a literal translation. But other than that, that was perfect.
The thing about all of them was how quick they were. They're very, very fast. So, I mean, one of the things I was doing was trying to work out which language it was. So obviously there was, what was the first one, Indonesian or Malay, I can't tell.
That was Indonesian.
There was a Slavonic language. It wasn't one of the ones that I speak.
That was Slovak.
Oh, there we go, because I noticed the ending was a little bit different. Then there was Italian. Then there was Chinese. No, the Italian was good. I mean, the thing about it is in Italian, when it's technical language, actually surprisingly, they're very similar, English and Italian, so it's harder to be identified as non-native. What usually gives it away is the phrasing. You get this awkward phrasing that gives it away as an English speaker trying to organize things because the word order is different. But in that particular text, you don't get any of that. It's all super fast.
So if this technology was used in place of a human interpreter and we could be sure it was accurate in, say, a conference setting or something like that, would that be acceptable?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
By the way, this technology is part of 11 Labs Dubbing Studio, and you can use it for dubbing video. So when you're wanting to translate the original into some other language, you can do it very precisely. You might want an utterance that's exactly 3.25 seconds rather than 3.35 seconds, and it will just do it for you very accurately. Unlike the days of old where, you know, the lip syncing was really bad.
Oh, yeah, totally. What really strikes you is how fast it is. There's no pausing. I mean, that's what's amazing, which means then it's easier for it to be thought of as native speaker-like. And, of course, the accents sound very good as well. But it is amazing how quickly you can press of a button, you can generate all of this.
Okay, so in this segment, we want to have a play with a new generative AI tool put out by Google. Of course, Google has its Gemini suite of large language models, which it's been busy improving and evolving. Now they've got a Gemini iteration called Gemini Live for chatting with him virtually real time. And by chatting here, I mean actually speaking and listening to the large language model. No need to input text prompts. So without further ado, let's have a go at interacting with Gemini Live right now.
My name is Gemini.
John, maybe you have a question for her?
Yeah. Hey, Gemini. What tips do you have in terms of language learning and language testing, you know, students at university? How can we use AI to best support our students' language learning?
AI could really help with language learning. It could give students personalized practice, like quizzes or conversation exercises tailored to their specific needs. AI could also provide feedback on things like grammar or pronunciation, which would be helpful. And it could even be used to create interactive learning materials like games or simulations to make language learning more fun.
So Gemini, tomorrow I'm going to teach a beginner level Chinese class. So can you give me, for example, a lesson plan for 2 hours? And that'd be great if you can show me some specific examples for classroom activities.
Sure thing. Here's a possible lesson plan outline for a 2-hour beginner Chinese class. To start, you could do a quick warm-up activity to get your students relaxed and focused. Maybe something like having them introduce themselves in Chinese or practice saying simple greetings. After that, you could move into introducing some basic vocabulary. Maybe focus on everyday objects like table, chair, book, and pen. You could use flashcards or real objects to help students learn the new words. Next, it would be a good time to introduce some simple sentence structures. Maybe...
Hang on. Gemini's dropped out. You know what I think it is? I think it's because my phone's screen times out and goes dark to preserve the battery, which cuts off our conversation with Gemini.
Mm.
So I guess this is my fault. I don't think it's Gemini.
Probably best to restart your phone to fix the issue. Then we can get back to planning your Chinese class.
Well, see, Gemini's on top of it. Gemini, you're ahead of us here, that's for sure. But Gemini, can you just, like, take over my phone and just make that change for me?
Unfortunately, I can't control your phone directly yet, but I can still help. Can you tell me what kind of phone you have so I can walk you through restarting it?
That's probably going too far, but let's go back to the Chinese lesson. I want you to continue from where you stopped.
All right, so for the second hour of your beginner Chinese class, let's start by reviewing the vocabulary and sentence structures from the first hour. You can do this with a quick quiz or a matching game. Then, it's time to introduce a few more words or phrases. Maybe some basic colors or numbers.
Don't stop. I'm just touching the screen so it stays on. All right, keep going, Gemini. Keep going.
All right, to wrap up the lesson, you could have a fun activity where students can use the vocabulary and sentence structures they learned. Maybe something like playing a game of bingo or having them create their own short dialogues. You could also give them some homework to practice with, like writing a few sentences using the new words, or listening to a short Chinese audio clip.
Okay, thanks so much. You've mentioned flashcards and bingo, those traditional games, but I'm keen to use generative AI into my classrooms. What do I do?
Okay, here's one idea for using generative AI with flashcards. Instead of traditional flashcards with just words and pictures, you could create digital flashcards with audio recordings of native speakers saying the words. This way, students can practice both listening and speaking. You could also use AI to generate quizzes or practice exercises based on the vocabulary you're teaching. This would save you time and give students more opportunities to practice.
Well, Gemini, I've got my own question.
Can you give me a short lesson plan for an introductory lesson on general linguistics? Not about language learning per se, but about general linguistics.
Okay, here's a possible outline for a short lesson on general linguistics. First, you could start with the basics. What is linguistics? You could explain that it's the scientific study of language and how we use it to communicate. Then, you could talk about the different branches of linguistics, like phonetics, phonology, morphology, and syntax. Next, you could move into a more interesting topic, like how languages change over time. You could give some examples of how words and grammar have evolved, and maybe even talk about language families.
Ah, well, that's a taste of Google Gemini Live. John, you, what are your thoughts?
Oh, well, mate, considering that we gave minimal details for the linguistics lesson, that's pretty good.
I think so. And also, I've asked it if I want to use Gen AI for those traditional methods like flashcards, bingo game, what do I do? And then her suggestion of using the digital flashcard, I don't know what that is, but it sounds intriguing. Yeah.
I mean, you know, you can just see where we're going to be in 5 years' time. It's quite extraordinary. Much faster. The rate of change is much faster than, and the autonomy, the freeing of humans from doing a lot of work is quite extraordinary.
Let's now move on to another area in languages and linguistics. Indigenous, minority, and other low-resource languages, some of them in the endangered category. Is there a role for generative AI technologies in researching, preserving, or revitalizing these languages? Our guest in this segment, Professor Stephen Bird, is a researcher of Australian Indigenous languages, as well as a computer scientist and computational linguist, and he isn't so sure. But first, we'll let Stephen introduce himself.
Yeah, so my name is Stephen Bird. I'm a research professor at the Northern Institute at Charles Darwin University in Darwin, in the top end of Australia. And I've been here for the past 7 years, focusing on working with First Nations communities and projects to examine how they keep their languages strong. And alongside that, I've had a long-term interest in technology and the ways in which technology can support linguistic diversity, or maybe sometimes perhaps get in the way of linguistic diversity. And it's a pleasure to join you folks on this program today.
Thank you. So, Stephen, is there a strong role or utility, do you think, for generative AI to greatly boost efforts to, I guess, help minority languages in need of preservation or revitalization? What's your broad take?
So broad take would be to just get a category distinction that I like, namely the distinction between Western institutionalization of languages. There's roughly up to about 500 languages with a writing system that's in use versus another 6,500 oral languages that are quite small in size. You know, the median size of a language is 10,000 speakers. And that don't have a standardized form of writing, don't have the institutions that enforce a particular way of writing. And so these languages have a lot of diversity. And these speech communities have a lot of multilinguality, and they speak one local language or more, plus often a language of wider communication to connect with the outside world. And so when we ask a question like, what can AI, especially large language models, do for languages, I think it helps to start out with this distinction and be aware that AI requires consistency of an institutionalized language, and that 500 or so languages, that's less than 10% of the 7,000 world's languages. So since your question is talking about small languages, what I've been calling local oral languages, AI doesn't have the standardized writing that it needs in order to build predictive models. And you can just imagine if you have multiple ways of writing the same word because it's not standardized and people aren't attached to how it's written, that adds a lot of noise. The assumption of large language models is consistent writing, in particular, the same word, even though it might be pronounced differently amongst speakers of different dialects, would be written one way so that any predicted model of what comes next based on previously occurring words doesn't get confused about the identity of two words that maybe happen to be spelt differently. So that standardization of text is not a feature of oral languages where people want to write in a way that approximates how they speak. And so without the support of years of schooling, which teaches you to memorize sight vocabulary and not really break it down into the phonemes and sound it out, that weighs against the spontaneous availability of modest to large collections of consistently written text that can be used for training AI.
Well, but what if we opted for a more multimodal approach to the capture of training data for the models? Less focus on orthography or writing systems and more on capturing the speech, the audio data from the languages for training.
Sure. So what we've experienced with the performance of large language models on English is based on, you know, upwards of 100 million words of training data. And that's assuming that the same word is written the same way consistently. But if we're going to go into the speech realm, the model has to learn that these different pronunciations by these different individuals amount to the same word in order to predict what's coming next and not train on the identity of the speaker. So we need vastly more. And the question in my mind is, when you have a median speaker population of 10,000 people, how are you going to get vastly more captured audio? And then there's a further interesting challenge, namely the local matters of concern. If you're interested in translating Wikipedia articles about, you know, Michelangelo into Papua New Guinea language, there's a whole world that has to be translated. And the same goes if it's the other direction. If we're talking about local Papuan traditions and trying to translate those into a Western language, we have to capture enough of culture in order to get this information across. So what I prefer to do is to start with these speech communities and ask, what is their agenda in the use of technology? Where do they already use technology? What are they asking for? Rather than say, hey, we've got this wonderful hammer of large language models, let's just solve any remaining problems. And, you know, often it's to do with fairness and bias and things like that. And so that then we can ethically roll it out across the world and have universal access to information, which is an agenda that we in the West aspire to.
I mean, what is enough? I mean, you say the median is 10,000. How many speakers is big enough for AI to be useful for in terms of speakers?
I guess we're talking about the quantity of tokens, yep, of text ultimately. And so a million words of text corresponds to, I believe it's 100 hours of speech. So that requirement for 100 million, mm-hmm, is, I think that's like 10,000 hours of speech. So let's suppose that's enough, 10,000 hours of speech. And we're talking about a community of 10,000 speakers. Mm-hmm. Then that's getting each person to speak for an hour.
Sounds reasonable.
But, depends what age.
But yeah, exactly. And there's different levels of language knowledge. The oldest speakers are missing teeth.
Yep.
The whole instruction to produce clean monologue into a microphone.
And not use loan words, not vary, yep, which is the other trick that that people often do. The challenge is, yeah.
Plus there's the kind of the phenomenon of language at the local level, primarily for dialogue. It's not primarily for information access where, you know, like when we consult something on the internet, we're happy to get back a document that answers that question. But language as used orally, traditionally, is highly embodied, situated, mm-hmm, interactional. And so if we're going to be getting speech in such community situations, it's going to be dialogue or even more participants. And from that, overlapping reference to context, reference to objects that we don't have a translation for, it's very noisy. And so I think you'd need a whole lot more. But I think even so, even with more data, we wouldn't get at something that's quite fundamental and missed out by large language models, which is the communicative intent of speakers. So when people are performing language along with other situated action, they have a purpose. They might be conducting a ceremony or transmitting knowledge to the next generation or preparing food, whatever that is. A lot of that context is not visible to a model which is just capturing spoken tokens and converting them into a uniform format.
But isn't that the job of someone who's sitting there tagging and, so, you know, explaining what this is all about? Or is that just not viable?
I suppose for concreteness, we could be talking about a remote Aboriginal community, but maybe we could be talking about regional varieties of Italian and what people might be doing when they speak that dialect, as opposed to maybe going to a local town and using a more normative variety of the language to conduct business. And simplifying a bit, I think at the local level, people are concerned with transmission of cultural practices and other existential matters, cultural survival, maintaining the country, doing all those things that give people their identity locally. But then when they go to the town and they're speaking, in the case of Aboriginal societies, they're speaking Aboriginal English, that's to conduct business in a Western way. That could be for education, policing, health, law, clinics and schools, so forth, which is very different business. And I believe that's the sweet spot for any use of AI to provide services to diverse communities. So, for example, in a recent set of interactions with a large technology company, I persuaded them to focus on building models of Australian Aboriginal English in preference to picking one of the ancestral languages, because speakers of the ancestral languages don't use their ancestral language when they want to do the kinds of information gathering or knowledge access with the outside world, where they would be, you know, going online or picking up a phone and typing or speaking. So I feel like it's very important to take seriously the way in which language varieties are used by the speech communities and the fact that they're multilingual communities and have a different function for each different language they command.
And Stephen, do you have colleagues working, say, with other languages that are having similar or different experiences with generative AI? I mean, what are their, what do you sense their use of it is or opinion of it is?
I was hearing last week from an archive of Indigenous languages that has about 35 languages represented. And they've been contacted by an AI company asking to extract the contents of the archive so that they can support those languages. And it's making them very leery to make their content available. And there's pressure, though, because there's potential of funding for participating in these things.
Funding from who?
From the technology companies to provide small amounts of funding in exchange for data. This, in fact, this is happening across the world. And now, for instance, in Africa, there's a project called the Masakane Project where NLP engineers are encouraged to provide data. So they bring their own language. So this is where an NLP researcher happens to speak a language of Africa, and they want their language included. And individual researchers are themselves trying to create more data in order to bootstrap ChatGPT and other technologies. There's so much prestige attached to having one's language included, and people's career, especially early career researchers, if they can participate in this way, then it's a prospect of getting their career on the road.
Well, that's very interesting. I mean, I understand the point you're making about, you know, it's about community and not about technology and, you know, using the language in the right context for the right purpose and understanding what's going on. I've got various different hats on. I'm going to ask you, is there anything that these languages bring that would, you know, make, between inverted commas, a generative AI better? Is there anything that they do or have that the big languages don't do that could make the models better?
One thing I've become aware of is this notion of culture area, mm-hmm. namely geographical regions where long-term contact between speakers of many different languages has, through intermarriage and trade, for example, has meant that there's a common stock of concepts across a culture area. So this would be, you know, the Mediterranean or Celtic area or the Sahel, mm-hmm. or in Australia, across the top end, especially Kimberley and Arnhem Land. Although there's a vast linguistic diversity with 14 language families, many of the same concerns arise. And so I call these zones of translatability. So what generative AI can do is translate or detect translational equivalences between the words of different languages because of their similar distribution in text without knowing what they refer to in the real world. That means that we could apply neural machine translation within these zones with great effect. Mm-hmm. And so, for instance, if anybody wanted to create a textbook for climate and emergency warnings and so forth in a language of Arnhem Land, then generative AI ideally would be able to support translation of that across to all the other local languages. So this sort of flips your question to mm-hmm. say, not what does language diversity bring generative AI, but what does generative AI offer to linguistic diversity? I guess I just want to call for people to bring what the full richness of what we know mm-hmm. about human language mm-hmm. and the way we dialogue, we interrupt, we clarify, we infer based on context and based on gesture, facial expression, history, expectation, all of that richness, and what we know about how communication works in co-construction of meaning. How can we bring all of that to bear when we think about what technology might offer us?
Isn't it just about even larger models that parameterize all of those additional things you're talking about?
I was hoping you wouldn't say that, Eric.
So, Stephen, what about in situations where language communities, you know, there aren't enough adults anymore, or perhaps the language is dying off, or the cultural practices are dying off, the ones that inform the language, and you want to preserve them? You may actually literally have to sort of upload that knowledge, perhaps, otherwise it's going to be lost. Isn't that better than nothing?
Yeah, is that better?
So a version of this was put to me earlier in the year by an anthropology professor who works with a company that wants to create embodied versions of ancestors to teach children to bring languages back. And he thought it was going to bring back a lot of these languages, and that by simulating the actual voice of that ancestor and maybe skinning it in a way that's recognizable, you would have this trustworthy authority, except they're not their person, they're a simulation. And if it's a child who's learning, they don't have the contextual knowledge to know whether that's true. And I want to ask, yeah, why? Where's this idea of using technology as a tool gone? And this is a question that was asked at the dawn of AI. So why is the assumption that a human's going to help a machine augment its capacity? Why is that somehow more exciting to the human psyche to make something in our image than it is to bolster what we can do?
Well, that's it for this episode of The Secret Life of Language. Special thanks to our guests, Professor Anthony Pym, Elise Ching and Dr. Leah Froman from the University of Melbourne, and Professor Stephen Bird from Charles Darwin University. It's producers for this episode were Eric Van Bemmel and Kelvin Parham of ProFactual and Gavin Naber. The Secret Life of Language is recorded and mixed at the Horwood Recording Studios by Gavin Naber and is a podcast from the University of Melbourne School of Languages and Linguistics. This episode was produced with the assistance of Generative AI Technologies. Be sure to keep up with every episode of The Secret Life of Language by following us on the Apple Podcast app, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. The Secret Life of Language is licensed under Creative Commons Copyright 2024, the University of Melbourne. I'm Professor John Hajek, and thank you for joining us.